Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Session 1 CFPB Developments conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you need any further assistance, please press star zero. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. Thank you. I would now like to hand the conference over to your presenters today. Presenters, you may begin the conference.
Hello, everyone. It's good to be in touch, if only virtually. This is Eric Mogilnicki. I lead the Consumer Financial Services practice at Covington, and I'm joined today by David Stein, who is also of the firm and who served with distinction at both the Fed and the CFPB before joining Covington. Thank you for joining us. This is the first of a financial services teleconference series called Taking Stock: The Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. The idea is that we would have a weekly series designed to help you stay current and, frankly, obtain CLE credits under the current difficult circumstances. Today's topic is CFPB developments, and in the next half hour, we'll cover the Bureau's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and all the other CFPB news that you may have missed along the way. Before we start with the substance, there are a few housekeeping items to mention. If you are interested in CLE credit, today's program is pre-approved for a half credit in New York and California. A link to download a remote attendee affirmation form and an evaluation form is embedded in the meeting confirmation notice you received yesterday. You will need to complete the remote attendee form, including the affirmation code that we'll share at the end of the call, and return the form to our colleague, Al McManus. Al's information is on the form. He will send you a certificate of attendance in due course. Al is also the person to email if you have any questions during the program. We'd be happy to answer as many as possible. We'll also stay on the line briefly after the half-hour session is done, and would be very happy to connect with any of you on an individual basis after that. So, on to our discussion. We've struggled, as I think everyone is these days, on balancing business as usual with the unusual circumstances of the COVID-19 emergency. Today, we're going to give you an update on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's response to COVID-19, and then we'll turn to business as usual initiatives that you may have missed in the flood of pandemic news. For that COVID-19 report, I'll turn to my colleague, David Stein.
Thank you, Eric, and thank you, everyone, for joining today. Hope this session and our future sessions will be informative. I wanted to run down with everyone today the list of actions the CFPB has taken in responding to COVID-19, and I think in doing so, it's helpful to break it down into two buckets. There's everything that the CFPB did prior to March 26, 2020, and then there's everything that the CFPB did on March 26, 2020, because I think they are sort of different in character and nature. And let's start with that first bucket, the early responses. The early responses were what you would typically expect in a crisis where the actual contours and extent are either limited in scope or not yet known. So to begin with, on March 18th, CFPB Director Kraninger issued a statement in support of the HUD and FHA moratorium on foreclosures and evictions. That was followed on March 22nd, where the CFPB joined with the other federal financial regulators and state banking regulators in issuing a joint statement on loan modification and reporting. And specifically, the statement gave the agency's views that loan modification programs would be seen as positive actions that can mitigate adverse effects on borrowers due to COVID-19. It also tried to provide some assurance that providing such loan modifications would not necessarily be treated as troubled debt restructurings. Independently, over the past several weeks, the CFPB issued a series of blog posts targeted at consumers to help them understand and reinforce some of the steps they could take if they were having financial hardship or other difficulties as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, these steps included things like contacting the lender or servicer for possible relief, working with housing and credit counselors, contacting debt collectors to reschedule payment plans, checking their credit reports, and last but not least, guarding against scams, particularly scams that may be targeted against older adults. The challenge with these steps, while obviously appropriate and well-meaning, is that many of them presuppose that you have financial institutions, housing and credit counselors, debt collectors, up and running at full capacity with call centers and other resources available to help consumers through these issues. And as the crisis has evolved, it became clear in the pivot that happened on March 26th that the CFPB realized that the COVID-19 crisis was impacting the operations of financial institutions and their ability to do business as usual. So that's where we have this shift to what I call the second phase on March 26th. And this was outlined, I think, quite nicely in a statement that CFPB Director Kraninger issued during the Financial Stability Oversight Council meeting. She recognized, and I quote, that many institutions are facing operational challenges due to COVID-19, and the priority must be responding to consumers facing nearer-term issues, end quote. As a result of that, Director Kraninger and the CFPB announced temporary and targeted regulatory flexibility so that institutions could focus on helping consumers. The director also indicated that the Bureau would continue to provide further relief as needed to ensure that resources can be focused on consumers. So turning now to the specific relief that was issued. On March 26th, the CFPB announced a series of measures, five of them in total, on its own initiative, designed to provide more flexibility and reduce administrative burden on financial institutions so they could focus their attention on making sure that consumers have access to credit and critical financial services. The first thing that they did was to delay quarterly HMDA reporting requirements until further notice. This means that the Bureau will not cite in an examination or initiate an enforcement action against any institution for failure to report its quarterly HMDA data. It's important to note that this does not mean that you can stop collecting HMDA data. The HMDA data still must be collected in the forms required by HMDA and Regulation C. It simply does not need to be reported until further notice. The second action was that the Bureau provided relief from certain submissions that are required related to credit cards and prepaid cards under both the Truth in Lending Act, Regulation Z, and Regulation E. These included the annual submission of agreements between credit card issuers and institutions of higher learning, the quarterly submission of consumer credit card agreements, the collection of certain credit card price and availability information, and the submission of prepaid account agreements and related information under Reg E. The third step the Bureau took is that they postponed two surveys, data collections that they were undertaking from financial institutions. The first was a survey of financial institutions regarding the cost of compliance with the anticipated small business data collection rule under Dodd-Frank Section 1071. This has been postponed without any new deadline being set. Similarly, another survey of firms providing clean energy financing or PACE loans was also deferred, and that also was in anticipation of a future rulemaking. The fourth step was the Bureau announced that it would provide some relief from examinations and enforcement. In a policy statement, the Bureau indicated that they will work with affected financial institutions in scheduling exams and other supervisory activities to minimize disruption and burden, and that similarly, enforcement activities would take into account current staffing and resource challenges. We had heard reports prior to March 26 that some staff at the Bureau were continuing to operate as business as usual, which was hampering the ability of financial institutions and their senior leadership to focus on sort of relief efforts for consumers. So this was a welcome development. And the fifth and final change that the Bureau undertook was that they, on the 26th, was they issued a Federal Register notice relating to the comment period, the supplemental comment period that they had opened on the debt collection rule, the proposed debt collection rule. That comment period was scheduled to close on May 4th. And the CFPB has now extended that comment deadline until June 5th. Also on March 26th, we had another interagency statement. This was the CFPB, the Federal Banking Agencies, and the NCUA issuing a joint statement encouraging responsible small-dollar lending in response to COVID-19. The statement encouraged financial institutions to offer responsible small dollar loans to both consumers and small businesses, recognizing that these kinds of small dollar loans could help consumers and small business customers meet their needs for credit due to temporary cash flow imbalances, unexpected expenses, or other income shortfalls during periods of economic stress or disaster recovery. The statement also indicated that existing products could be used or modified to meet these kinds of needs, including open-end lines of credit, closed-end installment loans, or appropriately structured single payment loans. A lot of that language sounds a lot like the way, in prior days we might describe payday loans. So then there's the second part to this statement, where the agencies caution that for all products, financial institutions should offer loans in a manner that's consistent with safe and sound practices, fair treatment, and consumer protection laws. And I think an unanswered question here is the statement provides no guidance as to how loans can be made in a responsible and safe and sound manner to small businesses that currently are not in business because they're closed, or to unemployed consumers. And I think there does seem to be a bit of a tension in this statement between encouraging responsible small dollar lending, but not really having a regulatory playbook at this point in time for defining what's safe and sound lending is in an economy that is largely shut down. The other thing I will mention just before I turn it back over to Eric is, the CFPB and the list of five things that they did and in Director Kranninger's statement indicated that there could certainly be more relief forthcoming. I will note that the five things that they provided are really relief as to regulatory burden between the institutions and the Bureau and the Bureau's sort of business as usual. We don't see anything in here that directly provides relief from consumer protections, such as relief from statement delivery requirements or relief from other disclosure requirements. I think that was deliberate, but that may be something that institutions may need or want to advocate for going forward, because that is not part of the relief. So with that brief summary, Eric, I will turn it over to you to see if you have any other comments or want to talk about the CARES Act and other issues related to the CFPB.
Thanks so much, David. Let me describe just briefly what's in the CARES Act that might matter to you. It's really beyond the scope of this call, and I know a lot of materials have been sent out. And we also, Covington has some terrific coronavirus resource pages, which you should consult if you want more in-depth on the Act. But I did want to draw your attention to three provisions. The first is Section 4021 of the CARES Act. This amends the Fair Credit Reporting Act to require that if furnishers make an accommodation on a credit obligation or an account of a consumer, and the consumer meets that obligation, the furnisher must report the credit obligation or account is current. Importantly, this does not require an accommodation, but relates to the reporting post-accommodation. Second, Section 4022 contains the foreclosure moratorium, which provides that a borrower with a federally backed mortgage loan who affirms that they're experiencing financial hardship during the COVID-19 emergency may obtain 180 days of forbearance from the servicer, which may be extended upon their request for another 180 days. Importantly, they need only assert that they're experiencing hardship during the emergency, not because of the emergency or because of the pandemic. There's a separate provision, 4023, which has a separate set of rules for forbearance on multifamily mortgage loans. And finally, the moratorium on eviction filings in the CARES Act can be found in Section 4024. It provides for a 120-day moratorium on legal action to recover possession of a covered dwelling for non-payment of rent. Also, fees and penalties related to non-payment may not be charged during that time. So that's a quick overview of some of the consumer protection-facing provisions of the CARES Act. I'd also note one other thing. The stimulus checks, as I'm sure you've noted, are going out. That means that in many institutions, there will be people thinking about whether that's an appropriate time to redouble or renew debt collection efforts. This is just a caution that the lawyers who have responsibility in those areas may want to get involved in those discussions so they can balance that understandable desire to collect with the interagency guidance that David mentioned and with reputational issues. Let me turn then, in the little time we have left, to business as usual. And we know it's hard to focus on business as usual. Nothing is as usual these days. But we do want to help you keep track of not just what's urgent, but other significant developments that may shape business once we return to something approaching normal. For the CFPB, that includes a group of developments from early March, three of them, a revised responsible business conduct bulletin, proposed whistleblower legislation, and a new advisory opinion process. I'll also cover a more recent development, a request for information to help the Consumer Financial Protection Law Task Force. The three developments that came first are, in a way, a package that fits together. And if you're looking for a theme, it's really there in the first sentences of the Responsible Business Conduct Bulletin. This Bureau believes, and I'm quoting now, in executing its statutory responsibilities, the Bureau places primary emphasis on preventing harm to consumers. Preventing harm to consumers is among the most effective and efficient ways of ensuring consumer access to a fair, transparent, and competitive financial market. End of quote. This is a contrast, I think, with what some consider to be an enforcement-first philosophy during the cordial years of the Bureau. And I think it's fair to say each of these three policies is designed to serve the goal of sort of preventing rather than punishing violations of consumer financial law. The first of these is the updated Responsible Business Conduct Bulletin. It's an update of the 2013 Responsible Business Conduct Bulletin, with which you may be familiar. As before, the Bureau is saying that responsible business conduct can, at least in theory, reduce civil money monetary penalties, prevent an enforcement action altogether, or prevent an examination finding. The differences between the old policy and the new policy are really the same differences in tone that we've been hearing since Director Cordray left the Bureau. There are a couple substantive differences I just highlight. The first is that self-policing, the first prong, is now self-assessment. This prong previously all but required that a financial institution be the first to identify a problem or legal issue. The revised policy, again called self-assessment, indicates an institution might be entitled to responsible business conduct credit if it devotes substantial resources to compliance, even if compliance did not prevent or detect the violations at issue. Second, the old bulletin singled out self-reporting, the second of the four prongs, as uniquely valuable to obtaining responsible business credit. The new bulletin deletes that emphasis and adds that the entity can self-report an issue without conceding that it's a legal violation. The bottom line here is that the new bulletin is a little less didactic and lowers the hurdle a bit for responsible business conduct, but it's still just an agency bulletin and will continue to be as valuable as the staff interpreting it in your individual case. Moving on, the Bureau on the same day sought to establish a whistleblower award program. The Bureau has long had a whistleblowing program, but doesn't have authority, unlike, say, the SEC or the IRS, to compensate whistleblowers with a cash award. The Bureau would like to be able to compensate whistleblowers, including and especially, it said, as it relates to fair lending violations. The Bureau can't give itself this authority, so the initiative amounts really to just a proposal for legislation. In particular, the Bureau proposed that the Consumer Financial Protection Act be amended to allow them to award whistleblowers between $50,000 and $10 million, depending upon the dollar amount of sanctions and other factors. My thought on this is that it's somewhat mystifying. It's sort of startling to see a Trump administration appointee emphasizing the critical role of whistleblowers a month or two after the president's scorn for whistleblowers during impeachment. Second, it's hard to see how the Bureau thought that such legislation would get through Congress in an election year. But it was part of this package of proposals, and I want to mention it. The third part of this package is, in contrast, immediately operative and I think immediately useful. It is the Bureau's new public advisory opinion program. The announcement follows a 2018 notice and request for information in which the Bureau sought input on establishing such a program. The new program allows regulated entities to petition the Bureau to interpret rules. The Bureau will then respond publicly and publish the responses in the Federal Register. The new program supplements, it does not replace, an existing regulatory inquiry program that results in private rather than publicly available interpretations. This may actually prove useful in the new term because, as we all know, the pandemic is raising novel legal issues. And I think one way to think of this is another option for resolving legal issues and in pursuing innovation along with the Bureau's other programs, including the regulatory sandbox, the no action letter, and trial disclosure policies. We'd be happy to talk to folks who are trying to figure out which of those programs to use and how to access them offline. The last development is one that's more recent. On March 27th, the Bureau issued a request for information to assist its task force on federal consumer financial law with recommendations on harmonizing, modernizing, and updating the federal consumer financial laws. This task force was established several months ago and is led by Professor Todd Zwicky of GW Law School. Specifically, the RFI seeks comments and information on expanding access to consumer financial products and services, protection of consumer data, Bureau regulations, federal and state coordination, and improving the market for consumer financial products and services. The comment period for the RFI will close 60 days after the date of its publication in the Federal Register. It's a little hard to know exactly how to interpret the RFI and whether we should all be racing to our computers to provide comments. On the one hand, it really is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to try to reshape the consumer financial laws. And I know there are a lot of people on this call with a lot of expertise and experience and who understand where the law is impeding rather than serving the interests of consumers and financial institutions alike. On the other hand, it is fair to note that the Bureau engaged in an enormously taxing RFI process in 2018. Many of us labored over thoughtful comments on the Bureau's enforcement and regulatory processes, and there's been relatively little action on those thoughtful comments that are now 2 years old. I would be happy to pause if there are questions. Okay. And I'm sorry, David corrects me via email. Todd is with George Mason Law School, not George Washington, which is not only a geographic but an ideological difference that's worth noting. Okay. As promised, we have pre-approved you for New York and California CLE. You'll need, though, this special code, which is 68HH. Capitalization matters. Both H's are lowercase. So that's 68HH. As I mentioned at the start of the program, too, this is really the first of a weekly teleconference series. We hope to be in touch with you week to week, and we hope that you'll find this series of value. We had planned next week to have our colleague Jeremy Newell, formerly of the Fed and the Bank Policy Institute, to focus on a very specific thing, the Fed proposed regulations governing determinations of whether a company has the ability to exercise a controlling influence over another company for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act and the Homeowners Loan Act. That regulation's now been delayed, like so many things, by about 6 months. But the new and improved topic I think you'll find quite useful, which is that Jeremy and others will talk about the Fed response to COVID-19, including programs under Title IV of the CARES Act. And so if you were trying to make sense of this enormous legislation, Jeremy Newell next Wednesday at noon can help you. You'll also find additional materials about this teleconference series on the events page of our website, which is at www.cov.com. And we also have a COV-19 toolkit page there, and links to both of those are included in the meeting materials. I know David and I speak for all our colleagues when we say we realize it's a very difficult time for everyone, and we're trying to do our best to help you sort of stay afloat at work while you worry about who's teaching the kids or where you're going to get toilet paper. So please feel free to reach out to either of us to stay on the line if you have, after the half hour's passed, if you have questions, and to let us know how we can be helpful going forward. That's all we have.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.